welcome to Conquering Leadership and the exciting, very exciting episode we have for you now is with the Australian Michael Jackson, who has a very broad and lengthy, rich career in the world of service, ranging through frontline employees to executive management of top brands that are globally recognized. And I'll let him speak to that in a minute. Michael is Australian born, I believe, out of Melbourne, but I met him over in Asia many, many moons ago. And today I'm talking to him on the fantastic global internet from Texas whilst he's in Macau. There's too many things I could say about Michael in his introduction and that I couldn't say about Michael because I just don't have the vocabulary to articulate everything he's done and delivered in a professional career that spanned at least two decades. But as I've said with previous guests on the show, I'm not indiscreet enough to give their age away. So I will leave that there. And Michael, welcome to the show. And how's that work for an intro?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Angus. Thank you. And two decades is very generous of you. Thank you. Thank you. What a great introduction.
Well, tell us a bit more about yourself, because the Australian Michael Jackson in and of itself is surely something we have to explore.
Yeah, I wasn't born Michael Jackson. It's just how it ended up. my surname is actually Jackson Colway. It's a hyphenated surname, a very British thing to do. My dad was British. So I grew up as a dual citizen. So as a British citizen in Australia, right. Which of course makes me an Australian citizen as well. And we can address that later on because it actually had an influence. For many years, I lived in Indonesia, which is a country where quite often they don't have any surnames at all. They just have one name. So you might just
like Madonna.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like Madonna or Cher, you know. So when I was applying for my residency in Indonesia, they said, so which is your last name, Jackson or Colway? And I said, no, they're both my last name. And they go, yeah, fine. But which one? And I go, no, they both are. And they went, oh, yeah. And so as you can imagine, it came back Michael Jackson. Because as soon as I mentioned my name, Michael Jackson Colway, I got as far as Jackson and everybody just burst out laughing. So I thought, I'm just going to go with this. And I go, yeah, sure, I'm Michael Jackson. And then learned every Michael Jackson joke on the planet.
Well, in the process, has that benefited your professional career?
No, it's great. And it was funny. As you mentioned, I do a lot of training and coaching. And it the moment you say, hey, my name is Michael Jackson, that's it. You bring a smile, ice broken, nothing more you have to do. It's great. Let everybody make the joke they're going to make because you know it. And if they don't make it, then I make it myself. And it's actually worked to my benefit. Yeah. And it is still my name. So, you know, it's okay. I'm not lying about anything.
So, I appreciate you sharing your nomenclature and this history. Let's dig a little bit deeper because I know I broad brushed your experience of service sector and you've been in the retail world through to hospitality, which I think again also cheapens a little bit the richness of your professional background. So tell us a little bit more about what iPerform does and specifically where you've had an impact with which type of companies?
Well, iPerform as a name has been around since about 2007. Prior to that, when we were in Indonesia, it was around for probably another 10 years before that. So it started as a company in Indonesia under a different name. And then when we left and moved to Australia, then we obviously changed the name and the company into an Australian company and an English name. As a company, myself and my partner, Tim, we were founding members of iPerform in one variation or another. And it started out as a love of training and a love of helping people. And it really isn't about, oh, what can I do to make money? Oh, I know, let's just go training. It was a natural progression from what we did. As we're talking about me in this episode, if we look back at where I had come from, when I was 14, my parents decided to open some restaurants. I got shanghaied into slave labor. So I was going to school during the day, a high school, My parents aren't here anymore, so you can't prosecute. So I was going to high school during the day and then working for them Thursday night through all day Saturday and Sunday. And the interesting thing about that, which it took me decades to appreciate what some of the things I learned, because I was doing stuff like washing dishes and cleaning floors, and then eventually I was able to progress into serving tables. The reason I was allowed to progress is suddenly I looked old enough to be allowed to do that. But what also happened is my parents, fairly early on in the piece, would take days off and just leave me in charge. And nobody thought that unusual. And then you look back and you think, yeah, okay, so now there's a 15-year-old in charge of a handful of staff. There are about 10 of us. And nobody thought that was unusual.
A bit of a child prodigy, are you, Michael?
Well, no, it's actually a tradition because Mum went through exactly the same thing, except in her case, it was even bigger. It was during the war, and her dad had owned a fairly large... in Australia, to put this in perspective for any Australian listener, in Australia, all country towns had a Greek milk bar, which the Americans would know as a drugstore or a soda fountain. And it was exactly modeled on that. So it was the whole, marble counter sitting up drinking sodas. And so my mum was the daughter of Greek immigrants. And that was just a phenomenon in Australia. If you're interested, you can Google it and you'll see it was a particularly Australian phenomenon.
So you're an economic migrant and a child prodigy.
I guess. So that's what happened to Mum. And so during the war, her brothers went to war. Yep. Mum was 14. Her father, who owned and was running their milk bar or their drugstore, he suddenly became very ill and there was no one to run it. And so they dragged Mum out of school, who had some experience. Here, now it's yours, manage it. And she had a team of about 50. And so it was sort of a family tradition. It's a shame you can't talk to my mum because she has a great story and it's about leadership, but we won't go there except to say it influenced me without me ever realizing it.
Well, I had a lady on the show a few weeks ago and we were talking about the ability of women. We were having the discussion around gender roles in the modern world and how in many cases women are better suited to executive roles than men.
And yes.
It sounds like your mum is carrying the candle for more women in executive roles than we probably even consider.
Absolutely. Her career just took her through into some serious leadership roles. And she didn't ever realize that that's what she had done. She ended up working for the Anglican Church, which is kind of interesting because she was a good Greek Orthodox girl. And the bishop of her area said, "We want you to lead this initiative." She said, "But I'm Greek Orthodox and I don't know anything about anything." And he said, "Yes, but you're the right person for the role." So they sent her off to university in Melbourne because she was in rural New South Wales.
Yeah.
They sent her to university in Melbourne for 2 years to study theology and what we now would know as leadership, and then brought her back. And she was in charge of the east coast of New South Wales, setting up a youth program, because in those days, country towns were quite isolated.
Yeah.
So she'd jump in her little van and travel for 11 months of the year up and down the coast. I've digressed, but it's very influential on me and what I have done.
Yeah, and you've piqued my interest there. I'd like to park it at the moment, people in roles rather than positions, because one of the recurring themes, I've seen it in some sports coaching over the last few years, is trying to get people who are coaches to understand there's roles on the field as well as positions on the field, and businesses have roles rather than positions, and yet we're obsessed with titles and we're obsessed with positions and we forget about the roles, and competencies are based on roles and so on and so forth. So you've opened up a pathway which I hope we can get back to, but I met you and your partner Tim. You guys were involved in the development of sales leadership for the Sofitel Hotel, which at the time was transitioning from five-star branding to luxury branding. And there's a whole bunch of concepts just in that phrase alone. Well, the experience was phenomenal. I perform transitions and transforms people.
Yes.
The nucleus of what you do as a people transformer and some of the arenas you've worked in. Let's have a little bit of a look at that.
Sure. Okay, focusing on what you just said, on iPerform, one of their niche markets was luxury sales. And luxury sales isn't necessarily sales for a company or a business that is a luxury business. We considered it to be sales for someone who wants to offer a service that would be considered appropriate in a luxury industry. So as you mentioned, one of our big clients for many years was Sofitel, where Sofitel had been considered a five-star brand of Accor. And their thinking at the time was they want to turn it into a luxury brand. So their Accor CEO at the time said, let's make Sofitel almost an autonomous brand. And so they formed a wholesale, and they said, what's going to change? The hotels will be the same hotels. We're not going to rebuild everything. The people who are employed in the hotels, we're not going to sack them all. What we're going to do is change the thinking. And they said that starts with the sales department because it's what the sales department offers the guests and the clients. And that's where they called us in. The reason they contacted iPerform, the reason being is that Tim and I had worked independently with members of people who were now part of that new sales department that had been formed for Sofitel.
And I just want to applaud you because going back however many years ago, that's actually really progressive thinking. So you've got sort of a non-tangible product is delving into the transformation of human resource capital.
Yes.
And change management. Yes. Creative thought disruption. I mean, that's phenomenally difficult. And yet you've made it work and you've picked up a massive brand. And I know you're being humble because you're not talking about some of the other brands you worked with. But you and I both know that the essence of change comes sometimes in the delivery and not in the people themselves. What I love discussing with you is all esoteric. But a lot of our audience out there are not in esoteric industries like us. They can't necessarily engage with a concept. So what can you give us is a couple of specific examples of transformation from A through B and what it takes to repackage a service. And as you just highlighted, it doesn't matter what industry you're in, we're all going to have to do it at some point somewhere.
Give you the background to the example I'm going to give you. You're right, our clients are very varied. We had a background originally in high-end hotels. And then some of our clients, which included L'Oreal and their brand Schwarzkopf, Swift, which is the interbank transfers, one of Australia's largest automotive groups. None of those are actually considered luxury brands. But what they wanted to provide their clients was a luxury service. And so in all the cases that I mentioned, they contacted us because they had heard of us as working with luxury hotels. And they said, that's what we want to offer our clients. So there's the background. What that means is changing a mindset into what is luxury and what is service, ergo, what's luxury service? And it's really changing the thought process, and it's changing the thought process of sales, which is how we started this. To be of service is not to be subservient. In fact, quite often it's the other way. It's to lead the service. It's to seriously consider what your client is in need of and also what they want, because we often know that's not always the same thing. It could be they say, I want an elephant at the wedding, but what they need is a wow factor. It doesn't have to be an elephant, but that's just what they've thought of. They just want a wow factor. And that's actually a real example. If we're looking at it from a leadership point of view, in that instance, it's about actually wanting to sincerely help your client identify what it is that will help them and lead them, using the word, leading them towards it. If we start talking in leadership values, leadership isn't, this is our credo. Leadership isn't necessarily directing. Leadership isn't pushing. Leadership isn't telling. It's actually encouraging. And if we like, it's showing the light at the end of the tunnel and how to get there. In this instance that we're discussing, which is in our trainings, yes, some of our trainings are actually quite obviously leadership. It's like training a CEO, coaching one-on-one, or a prospective CEO, or it could be a group of prospective leaders. So it might be through iPerform's history, we've done things like working with frontline teams to train them into supervisors and every level they're on. So then take the supervisors and help them into management, and then take the management and help them into higher levels, right up to taking groups of prospective CEOs and taking them into CEOs. And in every case, we found the common theme is when we've been training, often we've found that the participants have all started out seeing it as we have to tell our teams what to do. And that's how they've walked into it, particularly in Asia, where it's a very hierarchical structure. Whereas we actually explain, no, you don't push, you don't get the outcomes that way. You actually encourage. And also, and this is a very hard thing for many people to understand, is look at making yourself redundant. What you're doing is encouraging those people to eventually take your role. So how would you do that? If you were no longer scared of your own role and trying to keep people down so they don't take your role, then how would you encourage them to take your role and even go higher?
It's really interesting that you talk about redundancy, because there's aspects of coaching where I deal with executives or sports coaches, and I try not to use the word redundancy because it's a word that generates fear. I think what I'm coming to is what we need to do is encourage them to create redundancy, because that's how they develop professionally. And one of the things I've noticed in the last 10 years plus is the fact that leaders who don't empower or don't encourage evolution actually become worse, not better. Creating their own redundancy, they're encouraging their own evolution as a byproduct of the evolution of the teams behind them.
Evolution is a really good way of putting it, because one of the things that I've said to individuals and to groups is, how are you going to progress? How are you going to progress your own career if you're so busy hanging on to one position? Because if you're so busy hanging on to this, then you can't go any further, because you've now become so essential in that role that nobody wants to move you, or you've not thought of what else is out there for yourself.
Well, you sort of relegate yourself to an operational role and promote yourself from being a leader by running away from the things you need to develop in your own leadership. Michael, your career is, to me, enriching, because when I engaged with iPerform way back when, and with you and Tim, you guys lifted the scales off my eyes on many, many areas. And we're going to hopefully dig a little bit deeper into some of those as we evolve this conversation. But what I'd like to do is to, coming back to leadership, what defines leadership for you, Michael?
Leadership is encouraging whoever you're working with. We usually refer to it as teams, but you might be leading an individual. But leadership is encouraging and inspiring whoever you're working with to achieve above and beyond what they currently feel they're capable of. And my concept of leadership has evolved really recently. If you had to ask me this question last year, you would have had a different answer. But because the world is I'm going to say amazing place at the moment. Amazing isn't always a positive thing. You know, you can watch a house blow up and go, oh my God, that was amazing. It doesn't mean it was a positive thing. It was just literally the words amazing. So the world's in an amazing place at the moment where things are happening that we just couldn't even envisage happening.
Ever.
What it's done is it's thrown people into situations they would never, ever have considered. So leadership at the moment, there's a lot of reluctant leadership happening in the world. So when you ask, what is leadership to you? What does it mean to me? Leadership is guiding people through a path. And the path may have been planned or the path may not have been planned.
Yeah.
And a leader may have been the person that was the obvious person, but now they may not have been the obvious person. They could just be the person who happens to be standing when everyone around them has gone. But a leader is actually the person who's brave enough to actually accept that challenge that's been offered to them. And when we say offered the opportunity, now a lot of the boundaries have gone. So we could say being offered the opportunity. When we normally consider that phrase, we look at a company, an entity saying to a person or an individual, we would like to offer you this opportunity. But now the offers are different. The offers of opportunity could just be, there is no one here to take this role, so I will take the role because we need it.
Sorry, I'd like to just thrust a thought into there, because I remember when I first went to China way back when, you know, there's a lot of implicit bias, if you like, or prejudice about going to China. Then as I evolved, my awareness of the world, realized how many people would go overseas to work just for a pay packet. Actually hated going overseas. They didn't want to go overseas and work. And I found myself in positions many times over the years where I've gleaned opportunity from doing the things that other people aren't willing to do, which I actually found immensely exciting, which is the reason I left the UK, because the prospect of being 45 years in one or two establishments flying a desk was fundamentally horrific to me. I would rather take the job that no one, be a leader in the job that no one wants, than be the person who's conforming to time.
Yeah.
You mentioned inspiration, transformation, encouragement. Who inspired your journey?
I would have to say one of the greatest influences has been my partner, Tim. Because as you know, firstly, he's slightly older than me, so that means his path happened a few years before me. What I found inspirational, apart from everything else, he's not what one would have thought of to be a natural leader. Because when most people think of leaders, you actually think of someone more forceful. If we looked at what would be an archetypal leader, it would be someone who was more forceful, someone who was, I'm trying to find a word, but self-promoting is perhaps the way I mean it. And someone who is the natural guy to go, come on, chaps, this is the way, you know, we'll dash into war, you know, that sort of person. And Tim is absolutely the opposite to all those things. I know that many people who are listening have no idea who I'm talking about, but let me describe this person who is so inspiring, not just to me, but for the last 6 years, inspiring to 17,000 other people, because that's how many in his current team. He works for a casino group that I don't know if I, from your point of view, I can mention it, but I don't know if I can mention it from their point of view.
That's fine, to stay with casino group.
Yeah, so a casino group here in Macau, and he has, and they, up until this year, they employed 17,000 people between two properties. Tim is the director of learning and advancement, and even though he doesn't necessarily train 17,000 people every day, he trains a team, he trains, or he is the leader of a team that does. And Tim, his credo as a leader is there are leaders already in this company who are special. Our role is to make everyone feel special. So every single person they encounter every single day, he's instilled in his team, every team member that they encounter is worthy of a greeting.
Yeah.
And so if you've ever walked through the casino with Tim or any of his team members, it takes an hour to walk through because everyone they encounter gets a greeting, even if it's just a simple nod because they're in the process of doing something else. And he says part of our role is to actually spend at least an hour every day walking through acknowledging everybody because everybody deserves it.
When we were working together on some hotel projects, you taught me a phrase that I remember even now, management by walking around.
Yes.
Which isn't management by loafing around. It's walking around with purpose. You're engaging with the people who effectively are making your operation tick. I want to come to the impact on bottom line. And I know it's difficult to draw a line from that concept of engaged leadership through to bottom line productivity.
To start off, management by walking around. Thank you for remembering our phrase because I actually forgot it. Well, I forgot to use it. I don't forget the phrase. I forgot to use it now. But it's when you look at the two styles of managers, and I've dealt with them. The one that's aloof says, I'm a leader. I need to show that I am different. I need to show that I am something to aspire to. And my response to that is, if you're aloof and detached, you're showing nothing. You're just being there. And you could be as inspiring, and nonetheless it is, but as inspiring as the statue in the lobby of your building, you know, as inspiring as the statue of Abraham Lincoln. You know, yes, that is something to aspire to. However, it's not the statue that's aloof that's inspiring. It's actually the stories we hear of the man. So it's actually what he said and what he does, and it's actually making him real. And so then you have the other leader, and I've got some nice examples of this, the other leader who is open to his teams, and the other leader who is management by walking around. And the other leader who is showing that he's human as well. And that leader is inspiring, not something to aspire to, but it's someone that's inspiring by saying, hey guys, I support you. So what's the bottom line on this, you ask? How can we, the examples that I've had dollar for dollar, when we look at what's the return on investment here, one can say, if we want to use a hotel example, is, what does one general manager of a hotel do as opposed to his successor? And I've seen the example, hotel managers are chosen for their appropriate skills at the time. And I've seen hotel managers that have been in place leading a large team, and they've come out of, let's say, an accounting or a financial background. And so their role has been not interested in people so much. We need to make the dollars work.
Yeah.
We need to slash staff. We need to increase our return. And that person has been appropriate for the time.
Yeah.
Because the hotel has been in the condition that it's in. So what you normally find in that case is they make the hotel profitable through a reduction in spending, or a reduction in outgoings is a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
And then what you often find is that general manager will often be replaced with someone who is more focused on the human face of the hotel.
So they're fixers, they're sort of hotel mechanics in a temporary sense.
Yeah, In a way, yeah, because what you'll find is that then the first hotel manager has done a great job of bringing all the financial side of things into line. You know, there isn't unnecessary expenditure, and the outgoings have been reduced, which might be the staff are working harder and smarter. But then what you actually find is at one point you start to get team burnout, and the teams are saying, well, okay, but I don't feel like I'm a respected member of a team. In fact, I don't even necessarily feel that I am a team. And so there what happens is you'll find a general manager is replaced with another general manager that is now more focused on the softer skills, on the human resources side, for example. And often that's human resources / sales. And the impact that will have is then your teams will be inspired to deliver a higher level of service, because they want to deliver for their now leader. They want to give their leader what the leader needs. And I'll give you two examples of that. Because I live in Macau, I can talk about hotel examples and casino examples. Number one, one particular group, Wynn, actually I can name it in this case, Wynn Casinos, which has a reputation for service excellence. No group has a higher standard of customer service, because back in the day when Steve Wynn was the head of Wynn Casinos, his credo was, a happy team makes happy customers. If we instill that sense of luxury and service value in the team, then the customers will see it and will come and will return. Whereas another group, which is a more Chinese-run group here in Macau, which again is also very profitable. Oh, by the way, we're talking about pre-2020. 2020 is a disaster, but pre-2020. Another group, which is also very profitable, works the other way and says, well, we can splurge on the luxury of service when we've got our facts and figures right. Who is right and who is wrong? That's really hard to say, except that the other group that basically treats the service and the leadership style as, well, we can have the luxury of being nice once we've got the facts and figures in place. They always found that they were pushing, and they had a team, and I know a lot of their team members in all levels, from a housekeeper right through to some of the senior vice presidents.
Yeah.
And they say, my job is okay and my conditions are fine, but it's actually a really hard group to work with. Yeah. And what you often find is they have a high staff turnover. Whereas when we look at Wynn, most people, in fact, almost all people I've known who worked with Wynn say, we love our job. This is where we want to work. And part of that is actually then transferred down into their service level towards the clients. So how does it affect the bottom line? Ultimately, the frontline staff offer the service that the customers want. The customers will pay a premium for what they see as a higher level of service. And what we mean by that is service which adds value to the client. The client actually feels as a valued person. They don't feel like a commodity. They actually feel like this whole infrastructure around me, billions and billions of dollars, has been designed for my well-being. This person, we know, no, really, it's designed to make money. But how do you make that money? And that's what counts. The customers feel that, and I'm sorry, now I've done it again. I've gone off on a tangent. I've gone back into a service and sales level. But the customers feel that, yes, okay, if they look at it sensibly, yes, the business is here to make money by giving me what I want. The leaders are now, the leaders of those places are saying to their, are inspiring their teams to provide this service, not because they're told to, not because it's their jobs, but because they've been inspired to create this level of service because of the culture of the business. And so leadership isn't a person. Leadership is a culture. if you don't have the entire culture of the business believing in it, then you can't have the culture of leadership. And by the way, you're totally entitled to steer it. Sorry.
The reason I love this show is because people in the show make it rich. That's you. And everyone who comes on this show, whilst they look through a leadership lens, they bring education to the listeners, which is what you're doing right now. So it's very hard for me to step in and say, hey, Michael, because I'm listening to you, but I know that you're delivering a learning product. Thank you, by the way, for whoever's listening. And it triggered something that oftentimes people, and I've heard it a few times here in the US and back overseas about old school management or old school behaviors and humanity in leadership in the immediate, so the mid-war and immediate post-war generation. So not the boomers, sort of pre-boomers. People who've suffered are more human or more humane. People who've lived through a challenge are more likely to be forgiving and empathetic with those who've earned the rights to their role. And we see a lot. I remember growing up in the UK with the disdain for the House of Lords is not driven by the competencies or otherwise of certain people in the upper house. It was driven by those who inherited a position. And yet we see that today in a lot of organizations, you know, someone's groomed to inherit a position based on who they are, not based on what they can do. So what I'm hearing you say is kindness, being kind and caring, which I think is super relevant to the COVID era, actually may feel like an alien place to be, but ultimately it has a positive impact on your bottom line. So Michael, with this idea that humanity or kindness, being kind and caring as a leader, it sort of has, I think back in the 80s and part of the 90s, was displaced by or executive machismo. And now we seem to be coming back around to, particularly in the COVID world, actually, if we're kind to people and care about people, it does have a positive impact on our bottom line, our organizational performance.
Yes.
So I think following on, why do organizations lose their way? Being kind doesn't mean being weak. Being caring doesn't mean you can't be competitive. It is actually the opposite, and yet many organizations lose their way. What breaks that down?
A lot of organizations will lose their way because a business is a business and a focus on dollars and cents. And so when it's easy to be kind and caring when you're making money hand over fist, because you can afford what often, particularly the financial department, will consider to be luxuries. So, for example, if you were to provide, let's say you were to provide breakfast for your team, and let's say you had team get-togethers and team outings, and then the moment the dollars aren't as big as they used to be, they say, okay, this goes because that's a luxury. With respect, that's what a financial controller looks at. Why would you expect them to do anything different? Because that's their focus.
Yeah.
So I don't criticize it, not by any means, because that's their skill, that's their specialty. And they say, we focus on one area. It's like asking a footballer to win a diving competition. No, my area is football. And so as in many cases, businesses will suddenly rein in everything and will be seen to be unkind simply because they need to balance their books and they need to keep making the incomes that they make.
Yeah.
And if it's a larger company, they'll normally have a board of directors, and the board of directors or the shareholders, it's easy to give those directives because they don't see the human side of what they're doing. And I don't mean this as a horrible criticism, and I'm not a socialist, I promise. And I've run my own businesses and I've had my own teams that I employed. And so I understand how hard the decisions are. The companies that I see that survive and survive well are the ones that use that as the last resort. Because traditionally, I mean, just the fact that it's called human resources, it seemed as a resource. There's no humanity in there at all. And they go, how can we cut staff? It's easy because we can't knock down a factory. We'll just make less people do more work. Not everybody, I mean, I've got to say, when people make those decisions, they're not always insensitive. I have a friend who is a CEO of a very large, very well-respected hotel group in an extraordinarily high position. I remember one day we were having a conversation and he was very distressed himself because he said, I have to now make redundant over 1,000 people as a directive. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, all I can do is focus on the jobs that I'm saving as a result.
That's a really good segue, Michael, because one of the questions I want to ask you, and it ties in nicely, not only with the COVID era, but mental health awareness and executive challenges. How do you manage when you're making a decision or making an executive decision that's a bit of a Hobson's choice? I've got to let 1,000 go over there to keep 500 over here, which those 500 keep the business alive. So, in your experience, what advice do you have in terms of managing the stresses and strains of real life leadership?
Focus on the intent and focus on why it's being done. If it's your decision, let me talk about this more personally because I don't want to tell somebody else what to do, but I will say what works with me. When it's been my decision, I focus on the intent of it. Why am I doing it? Am I just doing this so that we can have a bit more money? So if ever I've had to put a team member off or more than one, is it just so we can have a bit more money? Could we have coped otherwise? Or could we cope otherwise? Or is it seriously because the business is endangered? The longevity of the business is endangered. If I'm the decision maker, I must say I look at the value of either keeping the resource, if you like, because it might be a decision I'm making over keeping team members, or it could be something as simple as keeping an office. You know, closing down an office and moving everybody into another office. So having one office instead of two. But particularly if we're looking at people, because that's a more emotional decision often, is it necessary? Is it we're just going to make a bit more money if we do it this way? Or is it that it will actually positively impact the business by doing it, and meaning the longevity of the business? Also, I consider the impact it will have long term. So at the moment, okay, and COVID is a perfect example of this. What can we really afford to continue doing, and what will be the end result? So, for example, if I was to say, all right, two team members have to go because it's really hard to keep them on. What I look at then is, with those two team members, what's my intent? Is my intent just mean I want to continue living the lifestyle that I have to the detriment of two other people? Or is the intent, I have 10 other people who are working and I want to keep them employed and I want to keep the business going, and therefore the only thing I have left to do is to put off two people for whom I have no work? And what are the other options? So when we look at mental health, it comes back to, I need to know that the whatever decision I'm making is actually the best decision, not just for me, but for everybody involved. And the long-term outcomes. So another option could be, instead of putting off two people, can I just cut down a few hours from all 12 people, but everybody has a little less, but it means that everybody continues having work? And what are the other options too? I mean, it could be that somebody actually, you know, I say, well, you know, Mary and John, I have to put them off at the moment. But what I didn't know is that Charles actually wants time off. So for, you know, and the irony is that I put the wrong person off, you know, I'm actually going to address this because I keep coming back to it, but it's just such a perfect example.
Yeah.
I talked about reluctant leaders. At the moment, I've been coaching three people that I call reluctant leaders.
Yeah.
They've been thrust in a position where they are leading a team. In one case, there's a person who's leading a team of about 150. And there's another person who's leading a team of about six. In both instances, they were never designated to be leaders. They never wanted to actually be the leader. In both instances, they were in operational roles. The person who was the leader, so in one case it's the CEO, was out of Macau when the borders closed and can't come back. So suddenly a person who just happened to have a senior but operational role and a technical role suddenly just became the highest ranking person in the business. And they said themselves, I am not a people person. I do not know how to lead people. I can't make these decisions. I can't tell people what to do.
Wow.
Because I knew this person, she said to me, it just started out as a conversation. And she said to me, I don't know what to do. And I think I'm drowning because I now have 150 people that suddenly turned to me and said, you're the second in charge. And it's like, no, I'm not the second in charge. And so she had this role thrust on her. And so how I've been helping her, she's saying, I don't know how to tell people what to do. And this comes back to intent again. And it comes back to, you don't have to tell them what to do. I said, in this case, be brave enough to ask them what to do. And this sort of wraps up a number of questions you've had. You know, how do we cope at the moment?
Yeah.
How do we cope with our mental health? Because in this case, this person was seriously concerned, having a sleepless night every night, just not functioning properly. Didn't know how to take this role. Said, I don't know how to be a leader, because the leadership style that she had experienced was always telling everybody what to do.
Right.
This is not your style. Use your style. Your style is asking people. Your style is actually inspiring people. Why they're looking at you is because you do what you do very well. It's a technical role, I admit, but you do it very well and you do it very naturally. So ask your teams, oh, but I'm not used to that. And I go, I know you're not used to it, but that's what this is about. You're learning. You don't have to be what you consider, let me put this another way. You can be in control. You can be a leader by being a part of the group. Do you know the JFK backstory about when he was in the army?
No, I'm going to let you have to sum that up in 60 seconds because I want to take you down another avenue.
I'll sum it up in less than 60 seconds. JFK in the army, he was on a PT boat and it got rammed by the Japanese. The boat blew up. No more boat. The Japanese went off. They were in the middle of the ocean. No one was coming for them. And they were there for hours and hours. There was no leader anymore. No natural leader. It wasn't just the highest ranking person. They were all, everyone was floating at sea miles from anywhere. And JFK just stepped up as just one of the guys who was there and said, okay, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
One of their colleagues had been badly burnt. Was almost unconscious. He stuck a life vest on him, put the life vest strap in his own teeth and said, follow me. And they swam to shore. Then they realized they were on an island that was uninhabitable. And so then they realized that ironically they'd been saved from drowning, but now they were going to die on a desert island. And he said, don't worry, guys. They had a lamp. He had a lamp. And he said, I'm going to swim back out to sea and flash the lamp. And hopefully one of our guys will see the lamp and come back. And that's what I mean by inspiring. He didn't tell people what to do. He just said, join with me, and just stepped up. And it really was, I am putting myself at risk for the good of the greater group. You guys stay here because there's no point us all swimming back out again. One of us will go out. Hopefully I'll survive. Hopefully I will find a way of saving us. But otherwise, at least you'll be here safe. for whatever you can, and you can think of whatever it is you're going to think of while I'm actively doing something. That's a leader.
Yeah.
That's an absolute leader.
Well, it's problem solving, isn't it? You know, the people today we need to solve problems need to be the ones solving the problems. Otherwise, you need to step aside and let someone else solve the problems.
And it comes up to being kind as well. You know, I am being kind. I am going out to do something for you. It's not in my best interests, but it's in our best interests. And that's a leader. And so it's in our best interests, not my best interest. In the 80s, I don't know. Did we get off track? Yeah, perhaps there was excesses around, because everybody, for a while there, everybody was earning a lot of money. Nobody really cared how that happened. You said you wanted to focus on something else. Am I not? If I'm heading down the path, let me go. If I'm not, bring me back.
Well, I think to the point, every decade has its excess, and every decade sort of has its challenge. And I think you've drawn an interesting line on the graph there on leadership. Is a lot of it's contextual. I'd like to pull you back a little bit, because you talked about mental health, and it's so apparent to me today that a lot of people are going to be struggling in the COVID world. And you know, linking this back to something you said earlier, if for example we're paying $5 per person in the company to have breakfast, then that actually in the COVID world is probably more valuable to the team. It's a great example of value versus cost, isn't it, in our leadership role? Don't cut the breakfast, because we don't know what's going on in people's lives. We don't know how they're managing with this, and maybe that's the one thing that brings them into work.
Exactly.
So, Michael, that was really interesting, because we just went from forced leadership because of COVID, creating situations where people were forced into leadership roles that they didn't necessarily want, but now have to overcome for the good of the organization, through to the evolution of natural leaders with the JFK example, where someone had to step up to the plate and take ownership of the problems and solve them. From your own experience, what could you share with us in terms of unique personal challenges that you've had to address and how you overcame them?
Firstly, I'll start it with whenever I feel overwhelmed by anything, I just stop and breathe, obviously, and then just say, it can be done, it has been done. And that's the first thing, because quite often when we feel overwhelmed and we say, I can't do this, I've never done it before, I just reassure myself that somebody's done it before. In fact, I can't think of anything in the whole wide world since forever that hasn't been done. I may not have done it, but somebody somewhere has done it, which means it can be done. And so once you actually acknowledge, of course it can be done, then the next thing I look at was how. A very simple thing is, don't be overwhelmed by the size of anything, and don't take it in its entirety. This is pretty straightforward. This is like project or task management 101. It's called how to eat an elephant. Have you ever heard that? You look at an elephant and go, oh my God, how can I eat an elephant? And of course, the answer is simple, in chunks.
One bite at a time.
One bite at a time. Now, it's absolutely politically incorrect to say that, but it's an adage, you know. We don't eat anything all at once. We eat it in chunks. So it'd be like even saying, how do you eat a pumpkin? You don't. You eat a pumpkin in chunks. However we're thrust into a leadership role at the moment, whether we're a reluctant leader or whether we're already an established leader, right now we can be overwhelmed by a lot of things, because there's so much happening and there's so much change. And so it's not just leadership management, it's also change management. And it's also, in many cases, change management of which we're not in control. And it could be something as simple as a border just closed, so now our businesses can't do business. It could be that our teams are no longer in front of us, so we don't know how to change to adapt to that. Acknowledge, number one, acknowledge that things have changed. Number two, it's actually okay to rant and rave about it at first and go, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Yes, there is probably somebody in a worse situation than you, but that doesn't mean your situation isn't bad. Or is it difficult? Sorry, I don't mean bad, but it's difficult. You know, a friend of mine, he's running a business, and he went, you know, I can't get the, it's a manufacturing business. And he said, I can't get the supplies. I can't talk to the people, blah, blah, blah. And he was upset about it. And then he turned around and said, and I shouldn't be complaining because we're in Macau. There's no issue. And I said, it's okay to complain because it is something that you didn't have to cope with last month. And now suddenly you've got to cope with it. There's someone better than you. There's better off than you. There's someone worse off than you. You are who you are. And this is what you cope with. So number one, understand that it's okay. Number two, rant and rave about it for a bit. Get it off your chest. Then number three, what that does is it helps you focus on what it is you can do moving forward. And if you work with a team, number four, and I absolutely believe in this, ask your team for their help. Because if you, it doesn't mean you have to accept every piece of advice they're going to give you, because if you've got 10 team members, you're going to get 10 answers and you can't do all of it. But say to the team, we're working as a team. This situation's new. What have you got to offer? What advice have you got, or what can you offer? Let's work at this together. I may not take every single piece of advice, but I want it. I always, and I've got to say, in my circumstance, I'm using the word I a lot now, but in a group situation, I rarely use I, it's always we. That's my management style. Not everybody has that style, but it's my style because I truly believe that we work as a team.
Yeah.
Whenever I've employed staff or been in a situation of a team around me, I've always believed we're we, because obviously if there's someone working with me, I need them. The business needs them.
Yep.
It's not me doing it. It's us doing it. And I think that's one way we're going to get through this.
Yeah.
Because it's not just me saying, come on, chaps. It's me saying, come on, chaps. Let's work at this together. Because somebody might have an idea. In fact, somebody will have an idea that I hadn't thought of, and that's going to be a key to what happens next.
You're forgiven for using the I word, because I did deliberately ask you an I question as opposed to a Y question.
Yes. Yeah. But it's, well, no, in English, yeah, but see there again, in English, there is no plural you. In Australia, we do have one. It's called yous.
Yous fellas over there.
Yeah, yous fellas, yeah. But the final part is, it doesn't matter who you are, understand you're not alone. And that's what a new leader actually feels. They feel alone. And particularly if they're a reluctant leader because they've been thrust into it. And what they feel is that they should be the one that comes up with all the answers. Understand, no one person comes up with all the answers. A true leader doesn't. I'm just going to wrap this up by giving the example of a general manager in a hotel. If they're just as one example, if they're financially focused, what they will do is surround themselves then by a good human resources team.
Mm-hmm.
If their focus has been on human resources, they'll surround themselves with a great financial controller and their team. It's okay to not know everything. Surround yourself with people who are strong in the areas that are not your strengths.
Yeah.
Focus on the areas that are your strengths.
Yeah. That's really good, Michael, actually. And it's a lovely bookend, because what I wanted to say was, when I worked with you and Tim way back when, you guys taught me stuff that aspects of leadership and aspects of not people management, but people relationships, I suppose, that, you know, prior to engaging with you guys at iPerform and then learning about the hotel industry, it was some... 15 years. So a span of 15 years of my professional life, when I look at a gap in leadership development. So I look back at Naval College as one of the biggest inspiring transformational periods of my life. And then fast forward 15 years, it was another 15 years before I met two people who influenced me because of an industry profession that made me think, oh my God. And so you can you can add one person to that list of 17,000 because I take stuff away from the hotel industry that I learned through iPerform that I still hold dear today. and it pays dividends, but I can't articulate it as well as you.
I've just always said I don't always acknowledge when I'm in a position of leadership. I don't realize it. And that's, I think, possibly also maybe can be one of the traits of a leader, because you don't feel like you're leading. I feel like I'm helping. I feel like I'm encouraging. I feel like I'm supporting. Yeah. The word leading is actually appropriate, because leading is, we're here, let's go there.
Right.
You're here, let's help you get there, wherever there is. Yeah. And there isn't always linear. So there have been circumstances where somebody wants to advance their career and they think the obvious next step is going from, let's say, supervisor to manager. But what I've helped them identify is that's what everybody around them thinks they should be doing, but what do they actually want to do? And the next step might just be moving into a different area and starting again. To me, a leader is encouraging someone to see what's best for them, and how to get there and how I can help them. At the same time, if I'm in a business role, then of course that is also making sure that the business needs are met. Because that's also part of the leader. You're helping everybody, including the business you work for.
Including the business, 100%. So I am going to force you, as we come to a close here, to answer an I question. These are not we questions. These last two are I questions. So you're looking all serious now. So of the I questions, Chris, the first one is, for me, I look back and the two things that have given me equilibrium that have helped me manage the pressures on my leadership journey and has always helped me restore some degree of equilibrium, no matter where I am mentally or physically or emotionally, are books and music. What book or piece of music helps you restore your equilibrium in your leadership world?
There's no particular book that I go to, but I will address it by saying a book that has inspired me, which I discovered fairly recently, was The 100-Year-Old Man Who Jumped Out, who climbed out the window and disappeared by Jonas Jonasson. Have you heard of it?
So I've heard of it now.
Okay. And the reason being, the story is kind of akin to Forrest Gump. Because most people do know Forrest Gump, just meaning it's fictional interspersed with fact. And so the premise of the book is literally a 100-year-old Swedish guy who climbed out of the window of his nursing home and disappeared because he didn't want to be as old as everybody was making him. Why it speaks to me is a couple of things. Firstly, throughout the book, he's put in a box. And throughout the books, he climbs out of that box because he doesn't belong in it. Secondly, at any age, and this is becoming more pertinent for me, at any age, you can do anything. This guy's 100 and he said, I don't like being in this box. I want to go out and have another adventure. The fun side of the book is that without this particular protagonist, nothing in the world that we know would ever have happened, because the book places him everywhere at every influential moment of modern history, of 20th century history. And he, one way or another, and it could just be by, you know, offering someone a cup of coffee, he changed the world. But the other thing is that why the book is inspirational is he doesn't find anything he does extraordinary. He just does it. And he doesn't find anything overwhelming. It's just, there it is. I just put the next foot forward. And so particularly in these times, I don't believe in coincidence, and that's a whole other conversation we can have. And I don't think it's coincidence that I found this book this year.
That's, I love stories like that, actually. I'm going to have to go and read this now. Now I've heard it in stereo. I need to make an intentional learning moment and pick that book up and read it. So my last question on the show, which is rather appropriate for you, I think, as you are a specialist in the world of luxury service. So recapping some of the key factors in your leadership layer cake include inspiration, encouragement, dedication, integrity, humanity, being kind, being caring. So I obviously believe that you walk the walk on all these things yourself. So in order you to continue walking that walk on your leadership journey, what one luxury item would you take with you for the rest of your time?
All right. Defining luxury as the absence of vulgarity, what luxury item would I take with me on my walk?
Beauty. Yeah, what luxury item would you take with you so you can continue to walk the walk as the leader exemplar that you want to be?
My luxury item would be beauty. And how I'm going to define that is it can be physical beauty that you can tangibly see. And this may not be the answer that you want, but it's the answer that you're getting. If it was to take something tangible, it would be to take something beautiful. That thing that would be beautiful. If it's a tangible thing, the beautiful thing would be a teddy bear. That sounds ridiculous, but it's a designer teddy bear that was given to me about 20 years ago, or a little bit less, maybe 15 years ago. It's actually a brand name teddy bear. It's a very limited edition. And I always admire the fact that it's a teddy bear. It is so perfectly made. I'm not necessarily a label collector, but that's something else you don't know, just to put this in perspective. My first study was design. Part of that was fashion design. And I look at the teddy bear and how beautifully it's sewn together, how the fabric aligns. It's got logo fabric on it, and how everything's aligned. It's perfect. It's symmetrical. So if that was something tangible that I had to take with me, it would be that, to remind me of, it doesn't have to be something spectacular like a multi-million dollar diamond. This little teddy bear guy who I have now personified, given him a name, his name is Eddie, and I can show him to you later. And he walks with me and he reminds me of a lot of things. He literally does travel with me. Whenever I go training anywhere, he actually travels with me in my briefcase. He sits on the plane seat with me. He starts a conversation, and he is literally a luxury item. He is a teddy bear that people would aspire to because of his cost. Fortunately, he was given to me. As I said, luxury is the absence of vulgarity. This teddy bear has no vulgarity in his design, his creation. But I also say beauty. It's a memory of something beautiful that I take with me. I use that. So if I happen to be in a leadership role, you know those moments where you think the whole world's just turned to rubbish? Yep. Or even sometimes in training, I'm up in front of a group of 20 people, yep, and I'm partway through and I just say, guys, let's take time out. I don't even know where I'm going with this. Let's stop and think of something beautiful for a minute, and then let's come back and start again. And so beauty can be anything. It could be a person that I decided is beautiful. This happens to me all the time. I'll walk down the street and there's nothing in it other than just pure beauty of the person. And the person doesn't mean that they're a supermodel or anything. It's just sometimes you walk past someone and you can feel the beauty coming out.
It's an essence.
It's an essence.
Yeah.
Or suddenly you'll see a scene or a something that's beautiful. And I take that with me because that helps me recharge.
Awesome. That's a fantastic example. And I love that. Actually, there's a lot wrapped up in that. And I'm sitting here thinking I need to go and buy my own teddy. So, Michael, that brings us to the end of this episode of Conquering Leadership. And thank you so much for being a part of this show and this series and providing us with your insights and your knowledge. And I do appreciate having you on here and you sharing your story. And I wish you the very best in the continuation of your journey.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity of being here. And I appreciate the opportunity of not only knowing you, but hearing you talk of your experiences. But obviously in this case, sometimes we don't realize the impact we've had on other people. And it's lovely to hear you relate the impact that this has had.